Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship for men and women who share their experience, strengths, and hope with each other so that they may solve their common problem and help others recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We're self-supporting to our own contributions. AA is not allowed with any sex, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Will you please join me in a few moments of silent prayer and meditation, followed by the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things that I cannot change, the courage to change the things that I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. If you like what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then here's our suggested program of recovery. I've asked a friend to come up here and read how it works from chapter 5 of the Big Book. Where is Edgar? I guess I don't. I got Edgar somewhere. Where was he at? Thank you. That'll teach y'all to start without me. Hi, everybody. Welcome. My name is Edgar, and I'm still a drunk. This is how it works from Chapter 5 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. As some of these we bought, we thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We ask his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made the decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, saw through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order! I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. C, that God could and would if He were sovereign. Thank you.
Thank you.
It is also a custom in this group to read a page from a 24-hour day book, and I've asked Red to come up here and do that.
My name is Red. I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. December the 12th, also today. Clergymen speak of a spirit of fellowship of the church. This is much closer to the AA way than the mere group therapy. Such fellowship is based on the common belief in God and common effort to live a spiritual life. We try to do this in AA. We also try to get down to the real problem in each other's lives. We try to open up to each other. We have a real desire to be of service to each other. We try to go deep down into the personal lives of our members. Do I appreciate the deep personal fellowship of AA? Meditation for the day. Love and fear cannot dwell together. By very nature, They cannot exist side by side. Fear is a very strong force, and therefore a weak and radiating love can be rooted by fear. But a strong love, a love that trusts in God, is sure eventually to conquer fear. The only sure way to dispel fear is to have the love of God more and more in your heart and soul. Prayer for the day. I pray that love would drive out the fear in my life. I pray that my fear will flee before the power of the love of God. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I'd like to welcome everyone today to the third anniversary of the Bellmead Group. Today we have a speaker from Meridian, and I'll have Gary come up in here to introduce her in just a minute. Bellmead Group met for the first time December 14, 2006, across the hall at the meeting room. There were seven members, many of whom are still active in AA today in the Bellmead Group. I want to thank everyone for coming out today to this celebration. At this time, I'd like to call David up here to introduce the speaker.
Hi, everybody. I'm David Anderson. I am an alcoholic. Sobriety date's June 18th of 92, and there's a bunch of people in my life grateful for that, me especially. First, I want to say congratulations to the Bell Mead group. 3 years is awesome. You know, my home group's the Meridian group. We're a little group, but we just got through celebrating 6 years, and a lot of groups don't make it, you know, and I've been to a few of y'all's meetings, and I like what I hear there. I hear a lot of solutions. I don't hear a lot of the problem. I don't get down here much, but I enjoy it. And I want to thank Cindy and Margie and Jamie for asking me to be involved and get the speaker. My first choice was my sponsor, Gary D. from Walnut Springs. And because of a work situation, he had to cancel out earlier this week, which is probably a good thing because now I don't have to stand up here and lie about him and tell you how good a guy he was. But his wife stepped up and sort of volunteered to do this deal. And I've known Laureen, I guess, what, 5 or 6 years now when they moved back to Bosque County. And she's one of those people that I just immediately pegged as a good AA. She's got a good program, and she's not one that just talks a good program. I can tell that she lives it. I've seen it in the group, but she's active in a lot of things, everywhere from the group to the area to just wherever she's needed. And, you know, it's one of those deals today when she was asked, she's ready to be here. And I'm not going to take any more of your time, Laureen. Laureen D. from Walnut Springs, come tell your story.
Thank you. My name's Laureen. I'm an alcoholic. And I thought you weren't going to get up here and lie. You said really nice things about me. It's not going to work. If nothing else, I want you guys to know that it works. It really does. It's on page 88 of the big book. And if you get bored and leave, I just want you to know and remember that, if nothing else. When I started out my life, I lived in Montana and Wyoming, and I was pretty much a country girl. I lived on cattle and horse ranches, but I never considered myself a cowgirl. I was a country girl. And one of those early memories I have is my dad teaching me how to ride. And there was the giddy-up part, and then there was the whoa part, you know. And I wanted to whoa a lot when I was younger. I was terrified. I was scared of everything. I was very shy. And I just kind of learned by observing and listening. I was afraid to open my mouth very much. I had a Coolie cup later on in my drinking career where I used to, it had something on there about I'd rather be quiet than open my mouth and remove, and thought a fool than to open my mouth and remove all doubt. So I thought that's a very good motto to live by. Of course, when I got to drinking, I didn't always follow that exactly. But back to the childhood first. I saw my parents get together with people in bars and at brandings and other people's houses and stuff. And the commonality to me that I can remember of those situations, everybody was drinking. Well, not as kids. But sometimes we did, but not as much as the parents did. So I, you know, I kind of thought, I guess, in the back of my mind that by the time I was able to handle booze, that meant I was an adult. So I went along. Like I said, I was pretty shy. I wound up sticking my nose and escaping life into books all the time. And eventually into movies, back to where I grew up in Hardin, Montana for several years. A couple of times we lived there. Dad being a cowboy meant we moved around to ranch to ranch to ranch, and because he didn't always get along with everybody. He was a very outgoing, gregarious person, but he was very opinionated. So anyhow, we moved a lot. The first time we lived in Hardin, my mother ran the Harriet Theater, and we used to get into every movie for free. And we could usually have all the candy we wanted. At least that's how I remember it. Maybe she didn't know we were having all that candy. Anyhow, and then the second time we lived in Hardin, we lived underneath the drive-in movie screen. Now, I don't know about your place around here, but our drive-in movie screen had two apartments underneath it. So I really wasn't just homeless and living underneath the drive-in movie screen. Anyhow, I liked living there because you could go around and watch those movies. And my job was in the summer was to go around and pick up and clean up. So I was making money. And I thought this was pretty cool, you know. So I guess long ways back, I started trying to find things to escape with. And I even kind of looked at church a time or two. The thing I remember the most about my experience in the Episcopal church I was baptized in was the Sunday that they took us out into the forest. And I was probably, fourth or fifth grade then. And the thing I remember was us building a little cross out of sticks and twine and putting a little rock base around it. That altar out there in the forest meant more to me than anything I'd ever found in those churches. And I guess it's because I knew that for me, my Creator was all around me, and I felt the closest to Him when I was outside. So that's another pattern that went on through my life. I used to like to go camping and all kinds of stuff, outdoors. You know, I had to be outdoors. Anyhow, I went along pretty good, though. I mean, I was a good girl, you know. I didn't get into trouble, did my schoolwork. When I was a sophomore in high school, it was the first time, I think it was sophomore, yeah. I remember drinking with a girlfriend of mine, a classmate, and the parents. It was like a New Year's Eve party or Christmas Eve party, one of those holiday parties. And we were drinking cold duck that my sister had snuck for us out of the front porch. We didn't even steal it ourselves, you know. We had to send my little sister to go do it. That's probably what made her an alcoholic. But she's one of us, too. Anyhow, we drank that cold duck that night, and I don't remember getting the sensation from it. Maybe I didn't drink enough, maybe because my drinking buddy turned out to be an alcoholic, too, and she, who knows? But the first time I really remember drinking to the point of getting drunk, I was at a party at a family house, and it was all of us high school kids, but the parents were there, and they took away our keys, and if we got drunk, we couldn't leave. Well, I rode with somebody, so that really wasn't going to be a problem for me. So I got drunk. I just started drinking beers, and I kept drinking beers, and I can remember looking at myself in the mirror and going, this is what it's all about. This is why the wrinkles go away on my dad's face when he gets drunk. This is a great feeling, you know? So that was my experience there. And I went straight from not drinking and never being drunk to being drunk, puking, passing out in the bedroom. You know, I didn't know how to whoa anymore. My dad had taught me how to whoa on the horse. I didn't know how to do that anymore. I kind of scared myself, probably, but by the end of that year, or by the end of my senior year when I graduated, I got myself into another situation, drinking. I was at a kegger out on Dump Road, a romantic place to go. And a bunch of strangers. Once again, I didn't know these people. It was in Sheridan, the town I lived near, and I was from Little Old Bighorn where I just graduated. And so here I am, you know, drinking out of the bottomless cup. When you're drinking out of a keg, you never know how many cups you have. You just keep drinking. And I rode back into town with somebody, and when I got back, I knew I'd had it. I was toast. I rolled out of that car and into the ditch, and I said, Flint, go tell Julie and Liz where I am. I'll be waiting here. Passed out in the ditch. I didn't say that, but that's what happened. And I woke up at about 4 o'clock in the morning, and Julie and Liz were gone. There were a few people down by a campfire, the diehards, probably a few of you guys, but you're tight, let me put it that way. I went down there, and I knew I needed to get a ride home. They thought I stayed in town when I went into town with that earlier ride. So I wound up in a carload of guys. I didn't mean to. I had even said, I don't want to go with just guys. But next thing you know, I'm drunk and kind of out of it still, you know, and barely functioning. I just stare at the fire. And on the way back into town, some of them started grabbing at me and scared the crap out of me. And when they stopped the car, it really scared the crap out of me. So I started fighting and kicking and screaming, and I tore one of the door handle off the Nova as they pulled me out of the back seat and somebody hauled off and hit me. I lost a shoe, and I got this scar. And about that time, somebody else came down the road. And he took me to the hospital. I don't know what would have happened. I know that God has always looked after me. I've always believed in a higher power. And he was definitely looking after me that night. It kind of put me on alert that I needed to not get so drunk that I couldn't be in, you know, take care of myself safely. And that worked pretty good for about 3 months. Because at that time, I started working for a dude ranch and called the Eaton's Dude Ranch. All these kids from back east came out there, and all their parents came out and rented cabins and rode horses. And I was one of the waitresses, and we lived in a bunkhouse, and across behind us were where the Wranglers all worked, and in their bunkhouse. And half the kids there were, like I said, from back east, but not me. I was kind of a replacement in the midsummer because somebody else had bailed. And I liked that job because I got up, I went to work, served breakfast, whatever they had. It was family style. Didn't have to take orders, didn't have to really, I never was a very good waitress. But when you're done with that, you can go back to bed and sleep. You didn't, you know, get up all night, sleep the night before. And get up and serve lunch and go back to bed or run around or whatever, serve dinner, and then you were free. And free usually meant let's go party. Let's go party some more. So we did. We'd sneak up to the dudes' cabins and steal beer and go down by the swimming pool and get drunk. And I don't know how many nights I did that. I was like I was in training for the future here. But at the end of that summer, the head wrangler married the head waitress. And to me, it always sounded like a funny fairy tale story. But my fairy tale didn't end very well. I went to the wedding, got smashed on champagne, went back to the ranch, served dinner. I was so blessed, but so were half of the other people that were working that night. So everybody's just laughing. It's no big deal. And I'm burning myself with the hot water coming out of there. I go, whoa, I think I'm burning myself. I don't even feel it. I was oblivious, you know. So I went back to town after that, went to the mint bar, drank some more, went to another kegger on the road out to the ranch, drank some more, decided I needed a little rest. So I stretched out in the car, and some guy wouldn't leave me alone, so I got up and drove. And I remember going off the road one side, and then I remember going, I don't remember anything. Next thing I know, I'm looking up, cracked windshield. I don't know what's going on. I just can't figure out where I am or what happened. I thought I was still at the kegger, and I had a cut above this eye, and somebody covered me up and gone for an ambulance. And when they came back, they picked me up. The guy said, if you've been drinking, you probably shouldn't tell them. Oh, okay. I was really naive. I probably would have said, yeah, I guess I had a few too many. I was always too honest, in certain ways, anyhow. So time goes by. I go off to college. I drink. I learn more about life. I don't get into too many more nasty scrapes like I seem to start out right there. When I came back to Sheridan after my year in Montana, I met my first husband. And he became quite an experience. He was probably one of us, and I didn't know it. I mean, he was exciting. He would buy new cars and trade and sell, and he had an airplane, and he lost that. But instead, let's buy a boat, and let's get another Eldorado. Let's get a pickup. What are we going to do now? It's time for glamping. Let's get a four-wheel drive, you know. That was life. But I thought I was in love, and I figured everything could be fixed. So after living together a couple of years, we got married. Now, his mother had told me, I love my son very much, but don't marry him. And he was 24 when I met him, and I became wife number 4. So as you can see, I wasn't any too smart anymore. We stayed married about 2 years. We moved down to Arizona, and it was one of those make or break things. I mean, I'd been through a lot and trying to learn. I mean, I was learning how to really drink and party too, of course, and really how to do the long weekends. And I was more of a binge drinker, and I didn't drink every day. So the situations had gotten bad. I didn't think he was faithful to me. He was not. He spent money like we had it. If we needed money, go get it from his mother. You know, not really a mature lifestyle. And he did hit me physically abused me a couple of times, and I was really not too keen on that, and to say the least. And that it didn't happen a lot. Let me just say that I had enough respect for myself to say you're not going to do that. But towards the end, when we were living in Phoenix, I was miserable. I knew our marriage wasn't working, and I found a bunch of party buddies down there, and I guess I felt I could break away from him. And I knew he'd always cheated on me, so I figured the best thing, my sick way of thinking, I don't think I would plan this, but was to cheat on him. And of course, that really wasn't a good thing to do for me, for myself. I'd always had this, my mother was very faithful to my father, and I thought, that's me too. That's how I am. But I wasn't. I didn't stay faithful. And that destroyed the marriage it, because of how I felt. I think he could have gotten over it. Because after he beat the crap out of me when I confessed, delusional, I guess, that was going to be a good idea, he said, yeah, I've been seeing somebody in Salt Lake City because he was driving trucks in. And I was like, oh. But it was over. That was over with that relationship. That was it. No more. I moved out, and eventually he moved away. And I stayed there. And my friends there did lots of other stuff than drink. And I found my powdered alcohol, and the years went by. All I can say is I used to have a lot of fun. I drank. I went to Mexico, and we camped on the beach. I went to Flagstaff, and we camped in the pine trees. I went to Roosevelt Lake, and we camped by the water. camp, and drink, and party. And that worked really well for a lot of years. For some reason, God still gave me gifts that I didn't deserve. And I wound up with a business. I didn't plan it. I just started doing it, and next thing you know, I had employees. And it grew, and I don't know how that really happened. I've always said God gave me this business. And then I had enough money to buy a house. Of course, and I was thinking that it was a good idea to take my payroll tax or my personal taxes and make the down payment on the house. That was a good idea because then I would save money and taxes, and my logic, once again, wasn't too good. But I got a house. I've moved my business there, and then I also had a pickup. I had my little four-wheel drive pickup, and as time went by, I had more money. I got an extended cab, and it was just I loved my truck. It was part of my identity. And so time goes by. I decided to go back to school because I never did fulfill my potential. When I graduated from high school, I was second in my class, and I could have had a scholarship to any school in the state of Wyoming for 4 years. My logic said, nope, I want to be an architect. I'm going to go to Bozeman, Montana. I think I lasted 2 weeks. That was right after the accident when I totaled my car and the dude ranch and stuff. So I guess, whatever. I was just in a tailspin, and my parents were getting divorced, and I didn't finish any schooling at all at that age. Well, I did do 1 year of fashion merchandising, if you can call that school. But I went back to school in Scottsdale and studied interior design. My business was making draperies and decorative things for the home, so it fit right in together, and I made a lot of good contacts. I did one semester full-time, and I thought I was going to have a nervous breakdown between my business and that, so I cut it back. It took me 4.5 years to get a 2-year degree. So if anybody's young enough and thinking of going to college now, do it now. Do not stop. go directly to school. Really wish I'd have done it, but it's too late now. Anyhow, I did do that. I did get it, and my business kept growing. I don't know. Things kept moving along pretty well. Along about 1987, my sister called me and said, I'm an alcoholic. And I was like, no, Kate, you're manic depressive. Don't worry about it. You're just exaggerating again. We always say, Kate, exaggerating again. So she decided, though, that she needed to go into treatment. And she went to Gillette, Montana, and I went up there to support her for family day. I think they kept her there something like 70 days out of a 30-day treatment program, something like that. And during this family day that I went to, I went in and they let me check her out, which is not very standard. But I took her with me, went to have pizza, and you know what goes with pizza, a big old pitcher of beer. So that's what I did, right there in front of her. And to me nowadays, it seems like, what a selfish, you know what? But it seemed perfectly normal to me back then to do that. And so I did. My sister stayed sober in spite of me. And there's more to that story. After she got out, she quit her job, and she moved to Arizona with me. Kind of a tough thing to do, but she did start going to AA right away, and I supported her. I was trying to be there for her, just listen. I didn't know anything about it. And I saw her go through a lot of tough times in early sobriety, but she stayed sober. She found a group of women that she could talk to. She found a sponsor. She got in a relationship. She got out of it because she wanted to stay sober and he didn't. And I thought, wow. You know, but my life wasn't anything like that. I was spiraling. I had, at one point there, I can't remember now if it was before Kate moved there, I think it was, I decided I might have a drug issue. And so all these people I used to hang out with, I quit hanging out with. And I stopped doing drugs for a whole year. I did not stop drinking. I still had lots of fun party things, but I didn't party with those same people because they were part of that group that did other stuff. And I found new friends. The ones that drank, some that didn't. But after a year, my logic told me that I was not an alcoholic, not an addict. I guess I can do this again, and I did. And it didn't take very long. I went right downhill again. And I was taking my sister with me to go buy my powdered alcohol, and she was like, kind of nonplussed, and I'm like, kind of, whatever, I need to do this. Selfish and self-centered. That was definitely me. So, right along in there, I was just driving up a street. And I'm hearing a horn honking, and I'm freaking out, trying to figure out what's going on. And the next thing I know, I'm going, what's wrong with this picture? I'm crashing into this car, and there's another car. And I'm like, luckily, nobody was hurt, and it wasn't my fault. But if I hadn't been high as a kite, I might have noticed what was happening around me. And that totaled my truck, which, of course, pissed me off. It was my truck. I marched over and sat down on the hood of this guy's car to write out my form. I'm like, you SOP. Never mind that he hauled off in an ambulance. You know, it's all about me. It's not about him. So, anyhow, I lost my truck, but I got a brand new one after that. But things are still bad. I could sense things are unmanageable now. I'm starting to sense that in my life. And I'm starting to feel really, really miserable. I didn't have any friends, hardly, that I could really trust. And I was pretty much a loner. And that's what I did. I lived alone, and I did my stuff during the day to keep me awake. And I drank beer at night so I could sleep, or whiskey, like that too. But I used to get out there in the middle of the night. I lived right on a real busy street, first of all, to preface this, so you'll know that I wasn't totally destructive. I'd get in my backyard and set up my A-frame ladder and plant one of those utility lamps to it, and I'd go to weed eating. I just thought that was a really good idea, and I had all kinds of energy, so why not? So I'd weed eat in the middle of the night, and nobody ever complained. I had a really nice lawn. Nicest lawn on the block. Thank you. Just uncontrolled. That's all it was. And somewhere along about May of 1989, I decided maybe I better quit doing these powdered things. And I went to my doctor and told him I was an addict. My sister is an alcoholic. I guess I turned out to be an addict. And so he told me to go to Camelback Hospital. I couldn't do that, but I wound up going to outpatient. And like a true alcoholic, I threw myself into it. I was going to Cocaine Anonymous, Codependence Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous. I can't remember. Anyhow, there was just a plethora of them that I was going to. And I was learning. I was willing. And my sponsor told me that one time after I'd been sober a while, and I was kind of surprised that she considered be willing, because I never had thought that about myself. And but I was willing, and I went to all these meetings, and a few months later I decided I wanted to maybe find a sponsor now. So I was in a little two-meeting person. There was little Carlton, little black guy, and me. That was it. It was a good meeting. And he said, I told him I wanted to get a sponsor, and he says, you go to Prince of Peace. There's a lot of good sobriety there, and I bet you can find somebody. He was absolutely correct. It's, you know, the things that happen when we're willing. And when I went to that meeting, the very first time I saw the lady that became my sponsor, but I didn't ask her, you know, I was a little bit coward about this thing yet, a little bit nervous. So I kept going to these meetings. They were there 7 days a week, which was, turned out to be a really good thing for me. And one time we had a meeting on having, being a sponsor. So I got in her group. It used to be a big group, and then we'd break up into groups of eight after the smoke break. And I listened to what she said, and I liked what she said. So I asked her to be my sponsor. And she said no. And I was like, you know, I already had heard that you're not supposed to say no. I'd never even conceived that a possible sponsor would say no. I was dumbfounded. And she says, well, and she talks like this too. Okay, I'll get back to you. You know, I'm like, okay, we can meet for coffee. We can be friends. Let's meet at the big boys. Okay, we'll do that. And when we met, she said, I've talked to my sponsor, and she said, I can sponsor you. Now, she was about 4 years sober then, and she hadn't sponsored yet, and I found out a long time later, after we had gone through a lot of steps, that within the year before that, I think that fall before I started working with Kay, I think she was the oldest daughter, was about my age, had overdosed and died of a cocaine problem. So she saw her daughter in me. She couldn't, I think that anybody else might ask her, and she'd think, yeah, but she knew my story already. She knew part of my background. And when I came into these rooms, to be perfectly honest, I did not think I had a drinking problem. That never really seemed to, you know, a couple of times I got out of control when I was right out of high school, a couple of times, and after that I had it handled, right? That's why I got beat up by my husband and cheated. No, anyhow, so I told her, or she told me that she could, and we proceeded to go through the steps, and we went through them very, very thoroughly, and it was a good experience, I have to say, and I love her to death. She's still my sponsor, even though it's a long ways away. I got to go back there for her 23rd AA birthday last February, and Kay had esophageal cancer at the time, and we were all afraid we were going to lose her. And she'd gone through all the treatment, and then she started feeling better, and when she knew I was coming over there, she said, oh, good, you can be here, and we can have a little get-together for my birthday. And I said, oh, that's a great idea. So Luann comes from California, and I come from Texas, and a bunch of her sponsees are still around there. And her sponsor comes, and her sponsor's daughter, who's been sober 6 months, and Kay's daughter, who she just about took the kids away from her, was sober like 2 years then. Talk about miracles in that room. There was a few tears that night. And it was so awesome to see this family tree, our AA tree of people that, you know, here's my grand sponsor, and here's my sister sponsor, and here's the sponsee, my first sponsee that stayed sober. She's there. You know, I'm like, I can't believe this. And it's just awesome. And if you haven't experienced that yet, stick around, because it's worth experiencing. When I first got here, the thing I got most right away was hope, because I was totally, totally miserable. And I saw in the big book here, a story talks about keys of the kingdom. It says, here was hope. Maybe I could find my way out of this agonizing existence. Perhaps I could find my freedom and peace and be able once again to call my soul my own. And that was so true. I was soulless, you know. If you looked in my eyes back then, I was not home. I might have been looking at you, but it was vacant, as they say. As I hung around these rooms, I realized that when I was young, I drank first. And when I stopped drugging, I still drank. And then after I quit doing the drugs, it was 6 months before I took my last drink. And I didn't party a lot then. You know, going to these meetings in these rooms kind of ruins that concept. It's not so fun anymore. And I came to say, yeah, I too am an alcoholic. I can stand in these rooms. I don't have to be an ANDA. It's part of my story. But I am an alcoholic. And I am really grateful to have found my way into these rooms, because there's such a wonderful spiritual program here. It talks about the spiritual program, spiritual experience in the back of the big book. I'm sure many of you have read it. It's one of my favorite parts. And it talks about willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness are the essentials of recovery. But these are indispensable. And when my sponsor first told me that I was willing, I was, like I said, sort of surprised that I'd had that. Most of you know that concept is how, honest, open-minded, and willing. So, of course, I was thinking about it today. And I brought my dictionaries. I love learning. So, and don't worry, this doesn't mean if you're one of those people whose sponsor says, before you go listen to a speaker, before the meeting starts, you go to the bathroom, you go get your cup of coffee, you have your cigarette, and then you sit your butt down and you don't leave. And if you're one of those people and you forgot to do the coffee thing, or the bathroom thing, don't worry, because I'm not going to talk that long. But anyhow, to me, the first part is the willingness. And then something else I've heard in this program, too. I think maybe part of me wanted to be a teacher of people. And what I've heard is that there are teachers in this program, and sometimes they're people you don't want to be like, you know, and there's some that you do. So I'll just leave it up to you to decide what you think about that. But for me, the first thought with willingness, I looked up will, because that's the source of it. And it says it's the mental faculty by which one deliberately chooses or decides upon a course of action. And to me, that always says so much when you think about what that says. A course of action. Now, isn't that what our program has us do? We have a course of action that we go on by taking the steps and by continuing to sponsor other people. This part really cracked me up, though. The will being the power to exert control over conflicting mental and emotional tendencies and arrive at one's own decision. My own decision back then, as you know, was have another beer. But the best definition I heard of willingness was not too long ago, and it was basically, Creator, let me help you help me. And I thought, wow, that was great. And when I looked up willingness in here, it says, will you help me? That was part of one of their examples. Will you help me? And I'm like, will. Wow. You know, put a lot in that message right there. And I even had one point in early sobriety, I wondered, what's God's will? What's God's will? Is it in this book somewhere? You know, not this book, but this book. And I couldn't find it. I really thought there should be some easy answers. I was really pissed off in early sobriety. I was angry all the time. I'd go into the rooms and you guys would be laughing and happy, happy, happy. And I'd say, what a bunch of crap. It's miserable. That's what life is. I'm sober, but I'm miserable. And I hadn't worked steps yet. No kidding. So after willingness, to me, I needed to be open-minded. I had to be willing first. Because that was willingness to go do what we needed to do, what I needed to do. And open-minded is being receptive to new ideas or to reason, free from prejudice or bias. And like I said, I wasn't real keen on church. I had a lot of prejudice and bias about that. I always saw those people as two-faced. And I can't think of the other word, but it's... just that they did one thing and said another, you know. And I thought that was just terrible. So why would I ever want to go to their churches where everything's so judgmental? So I kind of, you know, I closed up that whole spiritual thing in my life quite a ways back, except for being outdoors, you know. I kind of connected there. And, of course, once again, the root of that word is open, which is affording unobstructed entrance and exit, not shut or closed. So I had to, as it says here, be ready or willing to entertain or to consider some new idea, some new way of doing things, because what I was doing was just not working. And into, you know, to the best of my ability, I'm intelligent, I'm doing everything I possibly can, and everything I can possibly do is not enough. It's just not working. I'm miserable. Okay, we'll put away dictionary number one. I figured some of you people saw me rolling my little tapestry dolly in here. That's not my baggage I bring with me, okay? Anyhow, okay, the last one being honesty. And it is a quality or condition of being honest, integrity, or trustworthiness, which, once again, I hate it when they define things by the word. You know, I'm like, that doesn't get me anywhere. And I have to look up honest, of course. Not given to lying, cheating, stealing, or taking unfair advantage, truthful and trustworthy. Now, how many times have I heard that in these rooms? I was a liar, a cheat, and a, what's the next thing? A thief. There we go. And while I did some of that, I managed to rationalize other parts of it. But there were so many things that I had done, and it extended from, in my family, it was like, my grandfather cheated on my grandmother. My father cheated on my mother. My husband cheated on me. I cheated on him. And then the only thing left to do was cheat with my best friend's husband. And that was really put me in the pits. I mean, that's when I decided to quit doing drugs the first time. Maybe I was really doing something wrong here. No kidding. So anyhow, that honesty, I think, takes longer, and sometimes it can be, for me, I've been able to be honest about one situation, but another one takes a few years maybe to grow. Lately, I've been going through one of those issues. Somebody said at a meeting or a speaker one time that it was those were just character defects. But anyhow, I couldn't be honest with that yet. And recently, I received a new sponsor, a new gift, or sponsee, excuse me. And I really wasn't too willing. a friend of mine said we need to go pick her up and bring her home. They're kicking her out of there because the insurance won't cover it. Okay, so we do that. I'm not really willing, but I do it anyhow. It's kind of like coming here today. And anyhow, we drop her off, and she sounds like she is maybe ready this time. But my friend was telling her, you need a tough sponsor. You need somebody that will really push you. And I don't know how many times my friend has told me that I'm a sweet, gentle person, and they can get drunk, and I don't say, the hell with you. I say, let's go again, you know. And so she said, I can't do that. I was like, okay, well, maybe you should be your sponsor. But so then what happens a couple days later, this new person asks me to sponsor her. And I was like, well, okay, yes. I will. I'll do it. I'm thinking in my mind, this probably isn't going to work. You know, I shouldn't think that way, right? I know. That's another one of my problems. Character defects. So it turns out, after talking with her a few times, that she has a situation in her life that is identical, and I've never heard people talk about this in rooms or out of these rooms in private conversations where you bare everything. I never heard him talk about this, and she has that issue in her life. I'm like, holy cow, there are no mistakes, right? So I know God will give me the strength to go through it. And sometimes all I have to do is listen. But, you know, that's when I get out of myself. That's when I get out of myself. If I really pay attention to people, and I really do try and listen when people talk, It works. It gets me out of myself. It gets me out of my pity pot and my feeling sorry for myself. And oh, I'm getting old, and I don't even own a house anymore. My car is fairly new, but it's beat up by hail damage. Thank you, Texas. And I love it here, you guys, don't get me wrong. But anyhow, life has just been a series of good things happening. And if I can just get out of the way, they keep happening. When I was about 4 years sober, I was in a relationship with this guy I'd been dating off and on since before I'd gotten sober. And he and I had moved in together, which I always thought this would be, you know, the next advancement in our relationship. He was emotionally unavailable most of the time, but the fact that he asked me to do that, I was in heaven. You know, he could have proposed to me for all you know. That's the way I was acting. And that lasted about 9 months. And during that time, I discovered he was an alcoholic. I don't know how this happens. How do you attract other alcoholics? He looked like a really normal guy, and he was a good guy. But he'd go home at night, and he'd drink, and he'd pass out, and he wouldn't remember what happened, and he'd sleep on the sofa all night. And I was unhappy again. And so once again, I think this is what happens in my life, and probably some of you too. You get miserable enough with one situation, you roll around in it, fight it for a while, and finally you go, God damn it, I got to do something about this. So I was meditating. I was doing positive affirmations. Every morning I'd go out by the swimming pool, sit down, and do my affirmations. I took a class that summer on eliminating self-defeating behavior. And I was angry, and I wrote about it, and it worked. It helped me, and things just went along. And then that July, my sponsor and I had gone to a lot of different conferences together. I love to go to roundups. I think my first one was in Prescott, Arizona. And this one was in Payson, the first time they'd ever had one over there. And I like to go, but my sponsor doesn't like to camp. And this one didn't have hotels nearby, motels, whatever, at all. So I went alone. I just packed up my dog and my four-wheel drive, and I went. And set up my little camp and put my tarps out. You know, you got to have tarps. And it might rain, probably did. I can't remember. It's too long. Anyhow, I went to the meeting that night, and there was this guy that was chairing the meeting, and I was looking around to see who was going to be the speaker. This is something my sponsor got me doing, mindless entertainment, but trying to figure out who's going to be the speaker. Who's going to be the speaker? And when you go to one in Scottsdale, it's not so easy to tell all the time because a lot of those people dress up all the time. So anyhow, I figured out who it was. It was this white-haired gentleman sitting right in front of me. And I don't know what he was wearing now, I can't even tell you, but something that made me know that he was the speaker. And he got up, and the chairperson came over and sat down and kind of looked at this guy coming across the field. I thought, kind of cocky. And so I sat there, and afterwards, I went over to the coffee pot, and he's saying, we're all having another meeting up at the camp, y'all come up. No, I didn't say y'all that much, probably. But he is from Texas, actually, so... Anyhow, I went up there, and well, we hit it off that weekend, to make this long story short. And towards the end of it, I think it was, I took my dog over to the camp. It's a good excuse that one time to go by the camp again. And my black lab, German Shepherd mix, whatever he was a pretty big dog, but, you know, not huge. But then Gary's Bull Mastiff was bigger. And... I got close, but I thought I was not too close, and I had him on a leash, and it was like, he said, you better probably be careful. I said, oh, I know, but he's a good dog, he won't do anything. And we started to turn around to leave, and he goes, grrr, over his shoulder, and Chopper's on him, just like that. He lunged, and I guess he wasn't to the extent of his chain, and well, then he shook the dog, and I'm screaming, and everybody's hollering, and Rock Jim runs over and beats on the dog with a shovel, which finally breaks things up. And like, holy crap, I'm so embarrassed, first of all, and my dog has been bit, and I'm worried about him. So I take him back to the camp, and I check him out, and he seems to be okay, and somebody tells me, hey, we'll put this on him, and we'll give him this aspirin thingy and whatever, and I head back over to check on this guy Gary and find out if he was okay, because it turned out he got bit in the process trying to break him up. And we met in the middle of the camp. And literally, I'm not kidding, he comes to check on Buddy, and I'm going to check on him. And we hit it off. I went back. I had lunch with my sponsor on Tuesday, told her I'd met somebody, and I didn't know that anything would come of it, but I was done with the relationship I was in. It was toast. It was over. I told John on Wednesday. On Saturday, I moved out. That was it. I was clean and done. I mean, I worked through that process over months. I was agonized. I was unhappy. I didn't drink about it. I went to a lot more meetings. So I moved out, and we did hit it off. And a few months later, he moved down from Payson, and 3 years later, we got married. It's been 13 years ago now. So it works, you know. And those relationships in AA don't always work. And I'm very grateful, because I never have wanted to divide up who gets what group. Right now we only have the Meridian group. So what are we going to do? Yeah. We can't break up. No. Anyhow, when we moved over here, I was, things had just not been working out right in Phoenix. I had sold my business in 98, and it came up that he had a dream about helping his mom out, and she has a ranch outside of Walnut Springs. And it was weird, because he doesn't remember his dreams. And I looked at him, and if I remember right, I just said something like, "I guess we're moving to Texas," which was just like, how did you jump that logic, you know? But we did. We packed up and we moved over here, and things were up and down, and we were on the road. He was hauling cars from state to state. I went with him sometimes. And then when he got the big truck, I didn't go so much anymore, but it was an experience. And when we got here, I'd been living about 3 blocks away from my home group in Phoenix, and there's 1,500 plus meetings in the valley, and I could go to any ones I wanted to. And here I figured I was not going to make enough meetings to keep me sane. But when I got there, there were 2 in Meridian, and I started sponsoring someone almost right away, and she wanted to start a meeting on Saturdays because she needed it really bad. And we went to Friday nights at Laguna Park back then a lot. And then we started a jail meeting, which I'd never really done before. And then a few months later, I started getting into prison meetings, and I'd never done that before either. I've done things like answer the phones at central office and work on the public information committee at the area level and the intergroup level. I've just done whatever came along. The public information thing started by accident. I was answering the phones at central office. The chairman of the intergroup says, "I need somebody to take minutes tonight. We're trying to get this public information committee going. It's really important." He says, "If I do nothing else, I want to get that committee going again." Okay, I'll stay, but I don't know anything about it. So, you know, I'll take minutes tonight. I'll probably need to elect somebody else. And about a year and a half later, I rotated out of that position. And then somebody said, "Oh, you know about public information. Why don't you stand for the public information coordinator for the Area 03? Okay, sure, nobody knows me there hardly. Gary's been our GSR, but so I'll do it. Nobody else stood. So once again, but you know, I can't say I'm sorry. I was just willing. I just stepped up, and it's life has taken pretty good care of me, and I am just so grateful. And I feel like my sponsor. It looks like time's here. I'm going to stop talking.
My name's Jack. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank our speaker so very much for coming here. It was a wonderful story, and we sure appreciate it. Thank you. I just want to say a few things about the group. I came here just a little over 2 years ago to this group, and I don't know whether I was directed here or whatever. However I got here, I'm so glad I came to this group. It's been one of the best groups that I've ever been a member of, and it's been fun to watch it grow in the last 2 years I've been here. And I've seen numerous newcomers come into meetings, and a lot of them come back, and I think that's what makes the meeting so good. It's just a wonderful group, and I'm proud of it. That's about all I can say. At this time, we're going to have a drawing for a diamond pendant that Curtis made for us. And I want to thank Curtis for going to all the trouble to do that for us and his time. And I want to thank Curtis for being here, being in the meetings. So let's give him a hand.